I wanted to take up some themes that were initiated this morning, in particular in Peter Hansen's discussion about the United Nations and what might be done there. And I also want to touch on the policy of the United States with respect to those matters, and in particular that of Palestine statehood, which I think is a key issue, and of course is being taken to the UN by the government of Palestine, there are several key aspects of it. I mean, one is the question of whether Palestine really is a state, and it's my view that it is a state, that it has been a state at least since 1924. But that's something where I find there's a great deal of disagreement among scholars, even scholars who generally are taking positions supportive of the Palestinian cause. But I think it's quite clear that it is a state. If you look at the Treaty of Lausanne of 1924, the treaty that ended the First World War, you find the major powers are referring to Iraq, to Syria, to Palestine as being states. And the Permanent Court of International Justice, the court that preceded the current International Court of Justice, in a decision during the 1920s, also very clearly said that Palestine was a state as a successor to the Ottoman Empire in the territory of Palestine. So that's one very important point, which perhaps we can go into, because it's a point with some complications, and in particular what happens to the Palestine state after 1948, and it seems to me that Palestine did continue as a state after 1948, even though most of its territory was taken over. That is, and no. You did not find either Jordan or Egypt claiming sovereignty in the territory of Palestine. And then you get the Declaration of 1988, and then you get the observer state status of Palestine. And even though now Palestine is asking for a non-member state status for its observer mission, if you look at the way the UN has dealt with the observer mission that has been there now for several decades, they've really dealt with it as the observer mission of a state. That is, that they give Palestine the privileges that are given only to a state. For example, the right of reply in the General Assembly. So my view is that the UN effectively has considered Palestine to be a state for some time. I think it is an important issue. I think that to the extent that Palestine gains, let's say, greater acceptance as a state, I think it will enhance its ability to function in the international community, its ability to gain some kind of acceptable status for Palestine, whether it's a two-state solution or a one-state approach. And as well, in terms of the negotiations with Israel, of course, Israel says, well, the business of whether Palestine is a state is something we'll negotiate. And it clearly takes that off the table if Palestine is a state. I've always found it strange that the government of Israel can take that position, because if you look at the Declaration of Principles of 1993, it specifies the issues on which there is to be negotiation, and one of them is borders. There's nothing in the Declaration of Principles about Palestine statehood. That's not something that is on the table, according to the Declaration of Principles. And borders, with whom do you negotiate borders? You don't negotiate borders with an NGO, you negotiate borders with a state. So there's an implication there of statehood. There's also, of course, the question of the capacity of the International Criminal Court to deal with various issues relating to Palestine, prominently the Gaza War and the settlements. And to the extent that Palestine is accepted as a state, the declaration that it filed in January of 2099, you know, may may be accepted by the Office of the Prosecutor as a basis for initiating investigations into the atrocities of the Gaza war, and in particular into the settlements, because the statute of the International Criminal Court says quite clearly in the definition of war crimes that one form of war crime, or one manifestation of war crime, is facilitating settlements in occupied territory. So that's a very practical issue. The move that's being made now, of course, is to ask for non-member state status, which I think would be a significant advancement. It's a bit strange in that UNESCO has already done that, and UNESCO involves the same states that are in the General Assembly. So in a way, it seems a bit superfluous. And in a way, it seems odd that the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court didn't consider that a sufficiently a firm statement of the international position about Palestine statehood, because in order to become a member of UNESCO, you have to be a state. That's one of the requirements of admission, and Palestine was admitted by a comfortable margin in UNESCO. The other issue about how to proceed at the United Nations relates to membership. Of course, that's what Mr. Abbas asked for a year ago. The matter went to the Security Council. The United States put incredible pressure on a number of states that were at the time members of the Security Council to prevent there being a nine-member majority for that to go forward, because the United States was obviously prepared to veto but didn't want to have to veto. So it put great pressure on other states to avoid the possibility that it would be in a position of exercising the veto. One thing that I think is possible is that the General Assembly could deal with the membership issue on its own. That is, forget the Security Council and admit Palestine to membership. And it is generally assumed that the General Assembly does not have such a power. But in fact, I think it does. This comes under Article 4 of the Charter of the United Nations, which says that the General Assembly admits new members upon recommendation of the Security Council. So the question is, what does upon recommendation of the Security Council mean? Does it have to be a favorable recommendation, or does the General Assembly simply have to get some kind of advice, as it were, on the matter from the Security Council? And it has been widely assumed that the Security Council does have the role of being able to stop it. That is, if the General Assembly cannot do this on its own. If you go back to the drafting history of Article 4, however, it is quite clear that the opposite is what was intended in Article 4. That is, that the intent behind the language upon recommendation of the Security Council was that would be advisory only. And this comes out quite clearly in the proceedings of the UN Conference on International Organization that led to the drafting of the Charter in 1945. I won't go into the details. There will be an article in the George Washington International Law Review in about a month where I set all of this out, and set out as well the history of the veto. And if you look at the drafting history of the Charter, the veto was to apply to war and peace matters, so that a state that was a permanent member wouldn't be in the position of opposing the UN if it called for military action. But beyond war and peace, the veto was not to apply. It's rather clear from the drafting history, and the major powers, including the United States, said that on the record at the drafting history of the conference. So even if one were to consider that the Security Council has to give a positive recommendation, it seems to me that the veto does not apply when the Security Council votes on that issue. The other issue that I'll just mention briefly, where I think the United States has played a particularly a negative role is on the question of how one assesses the initiation of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza in 1967. On a variety of issues, you find the government of Israel justifying its position, justifying its continued retention of control, for example, by saying that it acted defensively in 1967, that Egypt was about to attack it, and that Israel needed to use military force against Egypt preemptively. If you look at what the foreign minister of Israel, Abba Eban, told the Security Council and the General Assembly in 1967, that's not what he was telling them. He was telling them that Egypt had in fact attacked. It was a concocted story, but that was the justification that the government of Israel gave at the time. And the United States was quite aware that this was not true. The United States had been very active in trying to discourage Israel from attacking Egypt all through the spring of 1967. The United States kept telling Israel, no, Egypt is really not going to attack you. You don't need to attack Egypt. And the Israeli government in particular, Abba Eban, kept coming back and saying, oh yes, we have information that Egypt is about to attack. And finally, actually, the head of the Mossad came to Washington and admitted to Robert McNamara that Egypt was not about to attack, even in the estimation of Israeli intelligence. But after the war went as it did, with a very quick victory for Israel, the United States covered up what it knew about the run-up to the war, and continues to do so to the present time. I mean, I think it's the current view of the U.S. government that Israel acted defensively in 1967. And I think that is something that does need to be challenged, you know, in various ways at the UN and in the public discussion about a wide range of issues, including in particular the settlements in the West Bank. Should I?
Yes. Thank you very much, John. Perhaps I could start with the first question. You have mentioned the possibility that Palestine might approach the General Assembly of the United Nations for non-member status later this year. You haven't said anything about the possibility that the International Criminal Court might consider this matter in November, because, as you know, a move has been made to the Bureau of the Assembly of State Parties to request it to place this matter on the agenda. And so it is possible that the Assembly of State Parties of the International Criminal Court may decide to admit the Palestinian declaration accepting jurisdiction of the court, which would have the effect of acknowledging the statehood of Palestine, at least for the purposes of the International Criminal Court. Could you comment a bit on that?
Yes, I think that would be the effect. The Assembly of States Parties has a role. I don't need to say this for Professor Dugard's benefit, because he knows all this much better than I do. But the Assembly of States Parties has a kind of oversight role under the statute of the International Criminal Court. And it has been approached by a number of scholars, actually led by Professor Dugard, to take a position on this issue, given the fact that the Office of the Prosecutor has kind of put it off. And that would be another significant step, certainly, in the international acceptance of Palestine as a state more broadly, even, you know, for matters beyond the International Criminal Court.
Thank you. Michael?
Yes, it's a follow-up to that question. But if, in fact, they do accept Palestine as a state, that's a recognition point. But there's a further point, is there not, in relation to the empowerment of Palestine in relation to the Criminal Court itself. In other words, the initiation of investigations and also requests for cases to be brought before it, some of which, of course, relate to Palestine. Would that not be a repercussion if it's successful?
Yes, that it would then put Palestine in the position of being able to initiate these cases. I think that's right. What Palestine did in 2009 was to file a declaration giving the court jurisdiction over any war crimes that had been committed in Palestine since the time of the court's entry into existence with jurisdiction, which is the date being July 1 of 2002. And that's quite broad. It gives the court jurisdiction to do investigations of quite a lot relating not only to the Gaza war but to other matters.
But sorry, yes, a supplementary. Please. I mean, the point is the court hasn't done anything of its own initiative. In other words, it's the same question that I raised this morning. They do nothing unless they're prompted. And giving them jurisdiction has not meant that they've steamed in to use it at all. Mm-hmm. No doubt they're afraid of various repercussions. But once Palestine becomes a recognized state in relation to the Assembly, it seems to me Palestine should then take a very active role in ensuring that cases are brought, war crimes, settlements, whatever you choose.
Yes, definitely. It's not only, as you say, a question of jurisdiction, but a question of bringing issues before the court by presenting information. That's how the court operates, is on the basis of information presented by states or by anyone else. And that clearly needs to follow and would be an additional issue. The fact that the court has jurisdiction doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to act or even that anybody will bring evidence before it. For an example, the Gaza flotilla, 2010, the Mavi Marmara, the acts that took place on board that ship resulting in deaths, possibly involving war crimes. That, in principle, is under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, because the Mavi Marmara, about a month before it sailed to Gaza, was re-registered from Turkey into the registry of the Comoros Islands. And the Comoros Islands is a state that is a party to the statute of the International Criminal Court, and according to the statute of the court, if an act occurs on board a vessel registered to a state party, that act comes within the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. So far, that hasn't been pursued. But to make the point here, there can be jurisdiction, but until someone acts upon it, the court is not going to do anything.
Well, if not, I think we must bring this session to an end. I simply wish to thank you very much, Professor Quigley. I think you've pointed out very clearly that the whole question of Palestinian statehood is on the agenda of the United Nations and the International Criminal Court, and that this has very serious implications for the future. I realize that the United States will do its best to block these measures, but I think these are important issues. Thank you.